I'm John Kroll, coming up on No Limits. Over the past 40 years, few forces have shaped Indianapolis and central Indiana more than the idea of the public-private partnership. Public-private partnerships literally have changed the landscape in the Circle City and helped define the ways Hoosiers shop, work, entertain themselves, and even live. Today we'll talk about the advantages and disadvantages of these partnerships that have helped build the city and the state in which we live. We'll talk with some of the architects of these partnerships, folks who have studied the partnerships closely, and you. Please join us by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending us comments or questions via Twitter or Facebook at WFYI. We look forward to talking with you. Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today about public-private partnerships, and we're fortunate to have a great guest list. I'd like to welcome to the program Jim Morris, president of Pacers Sports and Entertainment, and the former president of the United Nations World Food Program and the Lilly Endowment. Jim, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, John.
Good to have you here. Bill Reber, who is a professor of economics at Butler University. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Good to have you here. And Dr. Michael Twyman, director of the Indiana Grants Program for the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust. Michael, good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much, John.
Thanks for joining us. I want to start us here by making sure that we're all sort of talking about the same thing here, so I think I'm going to take it around the table. And I should say before we get started with this that I'd like our callers to, our listeners to jump in by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send questions or comments via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. But I'd like to make sure that we're all talking about the same thing or at least something resembling the same thing and start by asking everyone to sort of give me a rough definition of what should be considered a public-private partnership. I think I'll start with Bill Reber. Because he was making eye contact when I said it. So,
John, I would say it's a government agency working with a private entity to provide some good or service to the community for the betterment of that community.
Okay, and could you give me an example?
Well, certainly if we think about the athletic teams in Indiana, Indianapolis, the Pacers and the Colts would be good examples.
Okay. Jim Morris, how about your definition of public-private partnership?
Well, I would be close to where Bill is. I think it's where the public interest, the greater community common good, intersect with private interest for the betterment of everyone involved, where public and private resources and strengths can come together and make the overall opportunity better for the community than it would be if they were acting independently. And it's especially important for smaller communities like Indianapolis when you compare it to the Tier 1 cities, that for us to realize the aspirations we have for Indianapolis to be an extraordinary place, we all need to be headed in the same direction, working together, bringing together the strengths that each part of the equation has to offer, and together we can do remarkable things. We can be very competitive. And more often than not, public-private partnerships are about the business of making a community competitive to bring very bright young people to our city, to bring talent here, to recruit investment capital, to bring jobs here. And working in partnership together, we can accomplish a lot more than working by ourselves.
Dr. Michael Twyman, your definition of a public-private partnership.
Well, I would agree with everything that's been said, and probably I'm a little less parochial. I'll take some privilege with the title of your show, No Limits, and say that
sure.
My definition is probably just a little broader in that I think it's also looking at what is a need, an opportunity, or issue, and how is it that we look to the talents and the resources that exist, particularly in the private sector, that being corporations and businesses, as well as looking at government alongside nonprofits and institutional philanthropy. But in that, I would say in the area of philanthropy, there is the individual donor. And I would also say that we shouldn't separate citizens and taxpayers from looking at the government, because I think that many times the individual is very much a part of looking at public-private partnerships. So I take a very broad brush at looking at what are not only the opportunities to promote and advance public-private partnerships, but the role that each of us plays, even at a very grassroots level, in helping them to happen. There are very few opportunities or issues that having just one response or a uni-sector response would allow them to be effective in resolving. So most big things, and even a lot of the smaller things, require that both public and private are working in concert in order to bring resources to bear and to make a difference.
How old is Bill Reber of Butler University? How old is this concept of the public-private partnership?
Well, it goes back certainly almost to the founding of the country, in that we haven't separated out the private sector and the public sector. Of course, for Indianapolis, I would say with Mayor Goldsmith really started it here. It's been a model that Bart Peterson followed, Mayor Ballard. And other cities are starting to look at Indianapolis as well. I know the city of Detroit has recently talked about pursuing public-private partnerships in the last couple years. For many years, it did not. I think the unions, for example, in the public sector distrusted the idea of private-public partnerships. The jobs would be lost. We've been much more progressive, I would say, in Indianapolis, and have been looking at a broader picture in terms of the betterment of the city.
Jim Morris, when we talk about public-private partnerships, is that timeline correct in that it started with the Goldsmith administration, or does it go back further than that, would you say? And I'm asking you because I know you you actually have been one of the architects and one of the prime movers.
Probably because I'm the oldest of the bunch. Well, I would take it back to Mayor Barton's days and when he started the Greater Indianapolis Progress Committee, which was a vehicle to bring together the leaders of the private sector, broad-based in the community, to partner with the mayor's office and thinking about thinking together in a partnership mentality about the future of our city. Dick Lugar took it to the next level, the revitalization of the city market and the development of Market Square Arena. And the buildings to the north of the city market were a public-private partnership.
So we're really, and I just interrupt real quickly, and I'm going to throw it back to you, but we're talking now about 50 years because...
At least.
Yeah. Mayor Barton was the mayor here in the 1960s, and Dick Lugar
right.
was mayor late
1967.
60s. Yeah.
You know, like most things, I suppose it can be abused, but working together in common cause for the public good, emphasizing the strengths that we have, utilizing all of the talents of a community, all of the resources together to do things together that we couldn't do individually. Dick Lugar had a tremendous summer program for inner city kids called Upswing. It used the school facilities. Private businesses came in and partnered with schools. Volunteers were, by the hundreds, if not thousands, were engaged in these activities. And it was the coming together of the public and the private sectors to see the kids had special opportunities during the summertime.
And what was the impetus for, the first of these at least modern-era partnerships here in Indianapolis? To use the shorthand, what problem were they trying to solve at that time? Was there a feeling that the city was stagnant in the 60s or what?
Well, I think that Indianapolis in the last 50 years is a city that has had unusual aspirations and expectations for the kind of place that we wanted to be. We knew that we were in competition with places like Cincinnati and Columbus and in Louisville, and that we wanted our bright young people to stay here. We wanted more bright young people to come along, and we knew that to do that, we had to have a dynamic downtown. We had to have extraordinary public and private universities. Mm-hmm. They would both be better if they worked together. And for us to hit the home run that we have hit, mm-hmm. it required the best that all of us had to give. And, you know, we want the best faculty to be at Butler or IUPUI. Why will they come? Well, they'll come because it's an attractive city. It's a dynamic place. It's vital. It has, the downtown is the most important neighborhood of any city. It belongs to everyone. It's the place where we come together in a sense of community. And no single individual piece of the pie can pull this off in a major successful way working unilaterally.
Was it difficult to pull all those folks together in those years? I'm taking advantage of the fact that you seem to have been in the room for some of those meetings.
Well, difficult, maybe, but I think not so difficult. I think, why do things work? Why do people get along? Well, people, there is more that unites us than divides us. Our humanity brings us together. Mother Teresa said, if we don't have peace in the world, it's because we forgot we belong to each other. And, people want to live in a great community. They want good schools for their kids. They want good economic opportunities. And I think it's tedious work. I think you have to be engaging and open, inclusive, so that everybody can be a part of it and everybody sees why this is a good thing for everyone. Why did your wife fall in love with you? Well,
I'm sure she asked herself that upon occasion.
But it's because you paid attention to her, you were nice to her, you were inclusive, you treated her with respect, and the lesson is about the same.
Okay. Well, let me, Michael Twyman, you've got a point you want to make.
Well, I just wanted to speak to a certain aspect of, I think, local history. I had an opportunity to work for Mayor Goldsmith for a number of years, and one of my responsibilities was to begin to move forward with his agenda of wanting to look at ways that more people participated in providing service that had traditionally been rendered by the public sector, i.e., the municipal services that we all have become accustomed to having. And this whole idea of opening up the door that even nonprofit organizations, churches, being able to help work alongside parks departments to be able to do some of the maintenance and providing opportunities for a number of other organizations to, again, provide service. The impetus was that, in many ways, I think he felt, and there was a movement that government doesn't always do a good job at certain things, and it does oftentimes open up an opportunity for a special type of partnership when we're able to bring in other sectors, i.e., even the private sector, and private, in this case, would be private nonprofit, by and large, being able to participate in some of that economic mainstream.
We're talking about public-private partnerships here on No Limits, and I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, sending comments or questions via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. Real quickly, we've got just a little bit more than a minute until we take our first break to thank the people who made this program possible. What's been, in that time period, the most successful example of a public-private partnership in this city or state? Bill, you made eye contact again at the wrong moment, so I'll call on you. Bill Reber, Butler University.
I think, again, in terms of the sports, most of us follow the Pacers, we follow the Colts. We could not have attracted the Colts from Baltimore without having an environment where the public sector, the city, worked with the Colts ownership. And there's always some controversy in terms of how much public money goes to a sports team. We see that with the Pacers as well. I think for the most part, to be a major city, we have to have major athletic teams, and the pace isn't cold to that.
I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. We're going to take a short break here to thank the people who made the program possible. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by your membership and by the Indiana State Museum, presenting Nixon's Small World, opening October 15th. The exhibit offers an opportunity to discover photos documenting nature's complexity and spectrum of colors as seen through a microscope. Information online at indianamuseum.org. And by the Indianapolis Opera's production of Gilbert and Sullivan's comic opera, The Mikado, this Friday and Sunday. Tickets are available at indieopera.org. And by Green Bean Delivery, bringing organic produce and natural groceries to the greater Indianapolis area, with a variety of products from Indiana farmers and artisans. You can customize your orders online and receive groceries at your home or office. More at greenbeandelivery.com. You're tuned to No Limits here on WFYI 90.1 FM for your information. Tune in for Fresh Air. That's this evening at 7 o'clock.
Hello, I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and your host for No Limits. We thank you for joining us. This is Pledge Drive for WFYI, and I'd like to say No Limits is the latest addition to our local programming at WFYI Radio, and it's made possible by your support. If you've made a contribution during our fall Pledge Drive, we thank you. If not, please consider supporting WFYI and our local programming, our news, and shows such as No Limits, Sound Medicine, The Art of the Matter, and Blues House Party. You can call in your pledge at 1-800-233-0020 or make a donation online at WFYI.org. Thank you. We do appreciate your support, and this could not be done without you, so please make a pledge. We were talking right before the break about the most successful example of a public-private partnership, and Bill Reber pointed to the sports teams, probably the Pacers or the Colts. I'd like to get answers from Michael Twyman and Jim Morris, and then I see we're starting to get calls, so I think we'll open up the phone lines and see if we can get some people involved in the conversation that way. Michael Twyman, what would you say is the most successful example
of a public-private partnership? Well, I'm going to point to maybe two that are still in the making and have the potential, and one is the cultural trail that I think will really transform or has the potential to transform our city at a number of different levels, from even an economic development standpoint, but even as we look at cultural tourism and look at issues around accessibility and being able to experience the aesthetic and artistic value that our city has, and just to look at the investment of both public and private dollar in that undertaking, which is being held up as a real model for how to invigorate communities and to connect people and to really provide an opportunity to showcase the cultural amenities of the community. That the other one would be the Evolving Legacy Project as a result of the Super Bowl 2012 and the things that will happen on the Tech campus and in the Near East Side community, with again very serious investment of both public and private dollar in those endeavors.
Jim Morris, your thought on the most successful public-private partnership?
Well, John, there are a lot of them, but I guess maybe I would point to Riley Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. This is a remarkable public-private partnership. In the early 1920s, the Rotarians in the state of Indiana were looking for a way to honor the legacy of James Whitcomb Riley, and they said we ought to have a great hospital in the state of Indiana for kids, a place where the finest health care, pediatric care was available, and no child would ever be turned away for economic circumstances. So over the years, the state of Indiana, the Indiana University School of Medicine, the Riley Children's Foundation, with something approaching 40,000 private sector donors a year, have built this remarkable facility that is now, what, number six or seven in the country in terms of pediatric research. We'll see more than 300,000 patient visits this year. And every child in the state of Indiana, because of this public-private partnership, has access to the finest health care available for kids anywhere in the world.
We have got a caller who would like to join the conversation. I'm going to remind our listeners that they also can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending us their comments or questions via Twitter and Facebook at WFYI. Jane, I understand you're calling from Indianapolis. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for joining the program. It's good to have you
on
the
air
with us. What is your question?
My question is, the public-private partnerships, while can be seen very successful, there are some ramifications that I'm wondering if your presenters there have any firsthand experience with. Living in a number of different cities, and just recently for the last 3 years in Indianapolis, in the central part of Indianapolis, which would be considered very economically diverse, I have found that these partnerships have created a lack of services, very basic services, street cleaning, garbage pickup, police presence. And I wonder, do any of you live in an economically diverse area of the city that is suffering from these public-private partnerships?
Well, I'll throw that question, I guess, first to – no one's making eye contact with me at the moment, but I'll throw that one first to Michael Twyman, I think.
Okay, well,
it's a trick with my students,
right,
too.
Sure.
When they start looking at their shoes, I know it's a question no one wants to
I don't live in an area whereby I've experienced that, but I can speak to my experience in city government and knowing the importance of trust in developing partnerships that are effective and really work well. And it is not in any way a light matter that when people come together around any particular issue and resources are at stake, there is a process by which we come to some conclusion. And in that, it really requires that those who are invested have a certain amount of trust with that other party that their rights will be respected and that what they're all signing off on is something that people fully agree to. And I think sometimes when partnerships don't go as well is when, one, there is not that underlining of trust, but then, two, perhaps when people have not carried out or been true to what they've committed to. And then we sometimes see the consequences of perhaps agenda and other issues that can kind of get in the way of having a very positive outcome and solution. And sounds like what you're suggesting is maybe some partnerships that have gone awry because maybe some of those basic housekeeping issues relative not only to trust but an agreement upon the terms perhaps have not been well respected.
Jane, before we let you go, I was going to ask, please don't give me your precise street address or anything like that, but roughly what area of the city do you live in?
Right outside Fall Creek Place, and when we decided to come to Indianapolis, we looked at Fall Creek Place first, and then we thought we liked the diversity just across east of College. And what we have found, we have a lot of friends over in Fall Creek Place, is a dichotomy of services. And also that in Fall Creek Place, the it's just been very dramatic, the different service levels. And in our neighborhood, there is a neighborhood association, and they do attempt to work with the existing service providers, but the response has not been good. And it's been surprising to me. I have been shocked by it.
Response has not been good in what ways?
For example, when I moved in, I, of course, didn't have a garbage can. I needed one for my house, and it took 6 months for the city to provide that. Four different complaints. I went through the mayor's action line. Also, when I spoke to the garbage man that picked up my trash, since I didn't have a garbage can, he explained, just go and take one of your neighbors. He said, you know, they'll never send one out. Also, we, as a neighborhood, clean the College Bridge. We clean several different neighborhood parks because the city refuses to clean them and or maintain them. And I find that difficult to understand, given that it's city property and it should be maintained, and especially given the resources that we have in this community. And we have all these, what I consider very terrific public-private partnerships, but they're not making it throughout the city. They're only isolated in certain parts, and I think that needs to be addressed.
Jane, you've given us a lot to talk about here, and I think that you're going to shape probably the next 10 minutes of this conversation. Thank you for calling, and thank you for joining the program.
I really appreciate you having your show.
Thank you. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. One of the things that she gets to, I think, really is the that issue of accountability, which is one of the complaints critics have had about public-private partnerships, is that it diffuses responsibility. I see Bill Reber of Butler University nodding his head up and down. Could you speak to that a little bit? And I noticed, actually, when Jane was on the line, Michael's head was bobbing up and down when he was talking about some of the issues of effectiveness and accountability and how they were delivering services. But, Bill, we'll go first with you.
Well, that's always an issue with public-private partnerships in terms of who has the leverage to connect with the public sector. It's often people who are well-connected to begin with, and sometimes people who are in areas that aren't high-income or even middle-income may not have access to the public sector and the public officials to get the benefits of these partnerships. So that's always a concern. Now, I think we've done a pretty good job here in Indianapolis compared to other cities. As I said, both Republicans and Democrats have embraced the concept, which suggests it's done for pragmatic reasons, not ideological reasons. But that's always a concern. Who has access to the public officials? Is it people who are well-connected to begin with?
Michael Twyman, you were nodding your head like crazy when Jane was talking.
Well, only because it's a flashback from having worked in city government and being a recipient of those type of calls and issues that oftentimes happen in the neighborhood. And I think what Bill says is true, that in any partnership or relationship is important that everything is essentially honored. And this issue of kind of who's on first and how do we ensure that there's accountability, particularly even when you have shared responsibility or maybe in some cases even absolved it altogether to the other, where is the oversight? Where is making certain that, you know, customer service is rendered and is high quality? And just the importance of knowing that even in a partnership, you don't give up everything. It is indeed a partnership. And so at the end of the day, someone has to be responsible and be the entity that can ensure that things are done properly and in order.
Well, that is one of the other concerns or complaints that you'll hear raised about these, is that you will have, in effect, non-elected or non-government entities, in effect, driving the public agenda, because they'll offer up. Is that a fair criticism, do you think, Jim Morris?
Well, I think it's a fair issue. I would remind folks that all of the decisions as it relates to the construction of Lucas Oil Stadium, the White River State Park, Conseco Fieldhouse, were all ultimately approved by elected bodies. The City County Council would have approved the bond issues, would have approved all of the projects. So the political process does come in to play. Ultimately, all of decisions are supported by or are killed by the legislative body. The mayor would also then have a chance to veto it. Indianapolis is unusual in that our city county council, 29 members, is made up of 25 members from single-member districts. Indianapolis is divided up into 25 districts, and each of them has their own council member. And my advice to Jane would be to find a way to get well-connected. And it's not a hard thing to do, by the way. You know, political people are generally very responsive to their constituents. They want to win the next election. They're interested in their own popularity. And the opportunity to work through your councilman and to work through neighborhood associations. I think both parties have been very responsive. We have 400 neighborhoods in Indianapolis, and most of them are well organized. Goldsmith's Front Porch Alliance took it to the next level. And I think you can get people's attention. I can't imagine that Stuart Lowry or David Sherman wouldn't be eager to sit down and be a part of these partnerships. And in this regard, the neighborhood association and the resident represents both the public and the private interest, and it comes together that way. It just takes a little bit of effort, but it's not hard to do.
We are actually, the phone lines are lighting up here as if we're doing a fireworks display, so I'm gonna take a couple of the calls, but we got a very, very interesting question, tweet, that says simply, so what does the city do when the private part of the partnership goes away? The city is still here after businesses fail. What happens in those situations? Bill Reber of Butler University.
Well, ultimately, the city is responsible. If things don't go well with the private entity, then the city takes full responsibility. There are changes taking place all the time. There's evolution in terms of this process. So it's not a major mark against public-private partnerships. If the private entity doesn't do well, the government can take over that activity.
And in that case, do you have a Jim Morris, a different response to that question? Is it the buck does finally fall to the public sector then, right?
Well, I think it's back to your use of the word accountability.
Yeah.
For this to work over the long haul, and cities are, you know, you have to have a long view of what we aspire for our city. People have to do what they say they will do. Now, there are all sorts of examples where things for one reason or another don't work, but our country's become a great place because we take risks and we understand that, and we have to have our eyes wide open when we go into these situations, and good due diligence and good preparation are essential. But Indianapolis, most of these things have worked here. I mean, that's why our downtown is so remarkable, why IUPUI and the medical school is remarkable. While universities like Butler, the University of Indianapolis, they depend on the public sector for infrastructure and the private sector for financial support. This is a coming together of interest for the common good. And sometimes things aren't going to work. I wish that the world was perfect. It's not. But by and large, the risks are worth taking, in my judgment, if good thought's been given to it. It's the only way to make substantial progress.
And I'd like to pick up on that point real quickly. We do have callers, and I'm going to ask them to hang with us patiently here for just a couple more minutes because we are running up on a break, and I will get to them very, very quickly. But on that point, we've talked about, you know, public-private partnerships that were spectacular successes here. What's one that didn't work or didn't, at the very least, didn't work as well as it should have? Again, Jim Morris.
I suppose we could point to Union Station.
Yeah.
Union Station didn't work. Andy Jacobs told us that he didn't think it would work. Mm-hmm. But here was this great historic asset in the heart of downtown. And we had an opportunity to build a good hotel, to do several things that were important for the city. But the attractiveness of Union Station as a shopping facility or an entertainment facility didn't live up to the community's expectations.
You're listening to No Limits here on WFYI. I'm John Krall, your host. I'd like to invite, we've got several people waiting to get online, but I'd like to invite our listeners to call us at 1-866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. And please stay with us while we thank the folks who made this program possible.
No Limits is made possible by your membership and by Terry Lee Honda, offering direct access to Terry Lee every day. TLC is the Terry Lee commitment. Terry Lee Honda, new in Avon and U.S. Highway 36. More at terryleehonda.com. And by Houseworks, offering modern classic furniture, lighting, and accessories for over 25 years at 82nd and Allisonville Road. More at houseworks.biz. And by Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Friday nights here on 90.1 FM and HD1 WFYI Public Radio and on WFYI 1 Public Television. You're tuned to No Limits here on WFYI 90.1 FM for your information. Fresh Air is up this evening at 7 o'clock. To show your support for WFYI during our fall membership campaign, the toll-free number to call is 800-233-0020. Again, that toll-free number, 800-233-0020. Or show your support online with a pledge at WFYI.org.
Hello, I'm John Krall, and you are listening to No Limits. No Limits is the latest addition to our local programming at WFYI Radio, and it's made possible by your support. If you've made a contribution during our fall pledge drive, we thank you. If not, please consider supporting WFYI and our local programming. Our news and shows such as No Limits, Sound Medicine, The Art of the Matter, and Blues House Party. You can call in your pledge at 1-800-233-0020 or make a donation online at WFYI.org. I would encourage you to do that. Thank you. We have a lot of callers, and I'm going to ask our listeners to join us by calling 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send questions or comments via Twitter or Facebook at WFYI. I'm going to take a call from John Countryman, also from Indianapolis. John, are you with us?
I am with you. How are you?
We're doing well. Thank you for joining the program. What's your question?
Well, first of all, I'm a caller today as I was on my way to an appointment, and I heard two voices that I recognize. I was fortunate enough to be a student of Dr. Reber's at Butler University, and I know Mr. Morris from my days back at Brebeuf Jesuit. So thank you guys for taking time out of your busy day to be part of this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The thought that I wanted to share and also get the thoughts from the panel is the concept of sustainable community investment. And Mr. Morris mentioned that there's, you know, we get a lot of investment and we're risk takers. And for instance, the investment in Union Station may not have worked. My larger concern is that at the same time when the private part of that public partner partnership needs to step out of the equation because the economy is on hard times, potentially endowment values are down significantly as we may have experienced over the last 18 months, the very same time the tax receipts and municipal budgets would seem to be under pressure as well. So my concern is that we may build a park in good times, but then under a stress-tested scenario, which we just came through, we find ourselves not able to maintain those investments. So the spirit of ensuring that the investments made are available for generations to come, I think, is something to revisit.
Good question.
I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Good question. And I'll throw that one to your old professor first, Bill Reber. Thanks.
Well, John, the city's always going to be here, and Butler will always be here, too, so I think we're confident of all that. The sustainability aspect of it is that each new generation, each new mayor will build upon what came before. As I said before, we're pretty good here in our political situation in that we don't swing from left to right and back. There's a certain pro-community aspect of everyone who's involved with government. So I'm not that concerned that these projects will not be sustainable over time. There's a real commitment that people have, that the administrations have, and the sustainability aspect, I think, will be part of all of that.
Jim Morris, your thoughts.
Well, it's a very important question, and it's a very tough issue. Times, things that are very good decisions at one point in history, dynamics change, leadership changes, people see the world differently. It is a challenge to keep the momentum going in a community. You know, we have extraordinary arts and cultural assets. The city our size, nobody's better in the country. We have tremendous sports facilities, great parks. And how do you sustain that over time? And I suppose, you know, in tough times, we have to tighten up a little bit, just as we do at home. And it takes different solutions. That's why it's good to have bright people leading government, bright people leading private sector institutions who are creative and thoughtful and prudent. Union Station will be a good thing for the city over time. There are the hotel piece of it has been successful. The parking piece of it has been successful. They now have announced the new link into the convention center and the Lucas Oil Stadium. There are pieces of the old head house that are being used. It takes time. I was interested in Jane's comment earlier about the Fall Creek neighborhood and how that neighborhood was the old houses were torn down and the land was aggregated. And I think we all would have liked for that rehab to have been done instantly, but it took 30 years. And sometimes, you know, patience is just something that's called on. But the notion of how something's paid for over the long haul is really important.
I'm going to let Michael Twyman respond very quickly. We're really getting a lot of calls here,
very good.
And I want to get to them. So I
underscore what Jim said in terms of the importance of leadership. And one of the things I've always said about Indianapolis, that regardless of who's been in charge, this is a city that is well-governed. And I think when you look at issues around sustainability and looking at long-range planning and making sure that things stay afloat, we really have had the benefit of strong leadership that has governed the city well and which has created a culture for public and private partnerships to really flourish.
John, I want to thank you for joining the program. We're going to move on now because we've got
thank
a lot
you.
Of people in line behind you. But thank you for calling in. Good question. Before I take the next caller, we got an email from Chris White in Crawfordsville, who says, I would disagree that the relationship between national sports teams, Pacers and Colts, and the public, City of Indianapolis, State of Indiana, is a good example of win-win partnerships. A recent study published in the New York Times found that public taxes funded 87% of Lucas Oil Stadium and that the city still owes $61 million for the now-demolished Hoosier Dome for the benefit of sports fanatics around the region and the players, managers, staffs, and owners of those teams. I'm certain the recent bailout of the Pacers to continue playing at Conseco Fieldhouse is much the same story. I would posit that a better example of an effective public-private partnership is Lilly Pharmaceuticals in downtown Indianapolis. Bill Reber, you are you're furrowing your brow at that.
Well, if no other city provided public support for their professional teams, I would agree wholeheartedly. Tax dollars should be used to promote the general interest. And it pains me at times to see monies going to professional sports teams where the athletes are getting paid high salaries to begin with, and we're subsidizing those salaries. So to some extent, I agree wholeheartedly with the caller. But the world is such that we have to be competitive. And without the public-private partnerships for the athletic teams, we would not be.
Jim Morris.
I'll speak from my narrow self-interest with the
as
Pacers.
As president of Pacers Sports and Entertainment.
Not a penny from the recent CIB commitment goes to the Pacers. The $10 million loan goes to support about two-thirds of the operation of Conseco Fieldhouse. Conseco Fieldhouse brings 2 million people downtown Indianapolis each year. The Pacers and the other activity there generate all of the revenue to pay for the bonds to build the building. The city owns the building. The city has contracted with Pacers Sports and Entertainment to operate the building. And the resources, the loan that the city has made, will pay for the insurance, the utilities, the waste removal, the security of the building. Not a penny goes to the Pacers or the Fever. Now, the issue is having the Colts and the Pacers and the Fever a good thing for our community? And I would posit that it has changed the profile of the city. Today, we have the single largest hotel under construction in downtown Indianapolis anywhere in North America, a 1,628-room JW Marriott. Today, there are 66,000 people in central Indiana that are employed because of the success of the hospitality, the hotel, the convention, the entertainment business. And this is a part of what makes the whole thing work. And the fact of the matter is the tax revenues that come back dramatically outweigh the public investment and make it attractive for all sorts of things to happen here that otherwise wouldn't happen here. We've become one of the 10 or 12 most important successful convention locations in the United States of America. Who would have ever thought that would have happened? Who would have thought the Super Bowl would be here? Who would have thought we would have had six Final Fours and we'll have the women next year? This has changed the dynamics, the reputation, the vitality of our city, and everybody has got to make a little sacrifice to cause all these good things to happen.
I'd like to invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. We're talking with Jim Morris, Bill Reber, and Michael Twyman about public-private partnerships. I'm going to throw it now to Glenn, who is calling from Indianapolis and has been very, very patient. Glenn, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for hanging in
there. I just mentioned to Jim Morris that he remembers me when I filed suit against him and the water company for dumping their sludge into Fall Creek, which, by the way, we sat down and resolved it without any problem. So Jim is a great guy.
Okay.
But my question is, one of the options of privatization is going to civil service. And I guess I grew up with a competent civil service operation, but we've had a history here, whether it's at the state level, whereas I'm, in my view, the prejudice, the best state government we had was back under the Oremutz administration when I was working with the environmental agency, and it's gone downhill ever since then, is that to me, just like Lugar, Hudnut, Oremutz have shown us the right way to do things, and just like in the present mayor with Dave Sherman there, it's probably saved the city $500 million on the sewer operation by reengineering. And we need to get out of this thing of having all the patronage jobs, be they Republicans or Democrats, conservatives or liberals, and have competent professional government in civil service. The way to avoid that is to privatize, but I think the two can work together. But we need to get out this patronage system, be it, you know, present or be it the past operations. And if you look at the State Environmental Agency, it was the strongest it ever was under Oremutz, and it's gone down every year since then, to where in many of the federal programs, we are at the bottom of the list of getting federal money because we don't do our homework.
Glenn, I thank you for your call and your comment and question. I will see if Michael Twyman would like to respond at some level. And Glenn, I'm going to – okay, thank you very much.
I'm not sure what the question was, but I do think I understood the comment. This issue, though, I want to really pick up is the patronage and, I guess, maybe preferential treatment. Again, going back to the earlier part of our discussion, if we develop a system or maintain a system by which that is able to – exist and to flourish, it goes really against the whole premise and purpose of having public and private partnerships. And it, again, for me, goes into issues around trust and integrity and accountability.
We've gotten an email from Joyce Ribble of Indianapolis. She says, interesting program. Would you please explain what a successful outcome of a private public-private partnership is? Isn't it eventually more revenue for the city to put into city services for the benefit of residents? If so, then why are basic services like Indigo and our library systems, among others, struggling? Why must public money finance private sports corps if the revenue doesn't result in services? Why not just take that money, which seems to be available for these, and invest in city services? Bill Reber.
Well, with regard to libraries, there's a certain externality there. We don't want to charge for these books. The books are out there, so it's best to subsidize them. You can borrow them for free, essentially, because the knowledge is there to begin with. Same with public transportation. It takes off some of the pressure on the roads and highways with congestion and pollution. So when there are these externalities involved, government subsidies are warranted.
We've got just about 2 minutes left, and I'm gonna ask real quickly, what is the next great? Obviously, public-private partnerships, the standard people seem to think of when it comes to Indianapolis and Central Indiana are the ones related to sports teams. What's the next great area that's sort of ripe for public-private partnerships or this sort of collaboration? Michael Twyman.
Well, and. My world, philanthropy, you would probably hear strongly from the arts and cultural institutions that there is a need to, particularly in Indianapolis, to really look at the full breadth and scope of what the city has to offer, and that we have historically placed probably a higher priority in looking specifically at sports as we've built that as our signature moniker, and that there is also a number of other dimensions within our community that we should look to celebrate and expand and enhance. And I think that most would say, particularly as it relates to arts, culture, cultural tourism, that it needs to be par with what our investments and attention and priorities have been relative to becoming the sports capital, amateur sports capital of the world.
Got about 30 seconds. Jim Morris.
I couldn't agree with him more, but I would make the case that over the years, we probably have invested rightly, correctly, more in the cultural strength of our community. There wouldn't be many cities that would have a children's museum, an art museum. You know, there's 17 full-time symphony orchestras in North America. Indianapolis has one of the 17, and we're the smallest city of the 17. We found a way. The Idle Jorg, the State Museum, the zoo, the new ballet opera. We need to do better, but it's not either or. Great cities that win the competition have a whole panorama of things to offer.
This has been a fascinating program. I'd like to thank my guests for joining us. We've been joined by Jim Morris, president of Pacers Sports and Entertainment, former president of the United Nations World Food Program and the Lilly Endowment, Bill Reber, who's a professor of economics at Butler University, and Michael Twyman, who's the director of the Indiana Grants Program at the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us. It's been a fascinating program. Also like to invite our listeners to join us again next week when we'll be talking about how well Indianapolis welcomes citizens of Hispanic origin. We'll look forward to talking with you. I'm John Kroll. Thank you for spending this time with us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Executive Director Mary Hartnett. Producer Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator Melissa Davis. Technical Producer Cedric Freeman. Board Engineers Matt Sosi and Josh Hamig. And Intern Savannah Rains. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, and you can listen online at WFYI.org.